Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Let's see, a couple of announcements. There's a brochure on the table on Tassajara's summer work practice program. If you've got a 5 or 6 days of summer or longer, you'd like to get down and actually spend a week, which is an incredible experience. You get to kind of do the monastic schedule, but it's also an amazing place with babbling brooks and waterfalls and hot tubs, and give you a real taste for a Zen practice. So there's information on that. There's a kind of a Susan is going to do a workshop on making jizo. We had so much fun doing the covers for the chant books. She wants to do a little workshop at her studio where we both give a lecture one day starting April 11th on jizo, how jizo's actually used as a symbol. I should have brought a little statue of jizo. It's a patron saint of travelers and for children. And then people can repair to her studio for the next four, I think it's on a Thursdays, from 10 to 3, to actually make your own jizo. So more information on that. And their dates if you want to reserve them. And then there'll be a half-day sitting on the 21st. And we'll do it. Last time we did something different, we actually served lunch, which actually in the small room. And it really kind of brought the sitting together in a way that I hadn't experienced before. So there's a sign-up sheet for that. So I'd like to continue my lecture on the Heart Sutra. And as a kind of a preamble, I've given a series of lectures, but they've always been in a seminar setting, and I've been a little reluctant to give them in a larger setting like this because the text is pretty esoteric, and some people think of it as pretty intellectual, and it's kind of hard to kind of stay with the nuances of you know, second century Buddhist philosophy. But the heart of the Heart Sutra, and because we chant, it's probably the most popular or well-used sutra, really. Certainly in the Mahayana tradition. But I thought, as an introduction, it seems like I'm going to be spending a couple weeks just on the introduction. I thought what would be important for you to know is that the way in the Zen tradition we use the Heart Sutra is we don't actually study it. I mean, the level at which I'm giving you a presentation to the Heart Sutra is not much different than the way I learned it when I was a monk, when I was practicing. We don't spend a lot of time going through the fine nuances of the dialectic around what the sutra is actually presenting. We chant it with a sense of faith. I think for years I chanted it and actually know what most of the lines meant, you know. It was just a sense that it was speaking to me about my meditation practice as being something that I couldn't quite put into words, and that I shouldn't even try to put it into words. And I chanted it with that sense that somehow embedded in these words and in this practice of prajna was a relief from suffering. In Zen practice, actually, there are traditions, like in the Tibetan tradition, especially in the Gelugpa, the Dalai Lama's tradition, you may say that they're actually, the main thrust of their practice is actually studying this text, actually taking it apart very academically and on a level intellectually, and debating it and studying it. It's actually maybe more important than their meditation practice, that actually the amount of time they spend sitting on the cushion. That's not the case in Zen's practice. In Zen practice, the emphasis is much more immediate through our meditation practice, but more importantly, bringing our sense of presence and sincerity and gratitude to our everyday activity. And so I thought I would read a section from Suzuki Roshi in and how I think in these few chapters he really synthesizes really well, I think, what Zen practice is. He says, "So the purpose of my talk is to express my appreciation. That's all. Our way is not to sit to acquire something. It is to express our true nature. So that's really the heart of Zen practice. We sit with this faith that we have our true nature and that we want to express it. And the reason I want to give you the Heart Sutra, because as we begin to explain what this Prajnaparamita or this transcendental wisdom is, it gives you much more of an understanding of what we're talking about when we say over and over again, what is our true nature? What is our unconditioned nature? What is this vast, expansive potential of our consciousness that we have, and we just need to find a way to express it more in our life and access it? If you want to express yourself, your true nature, there should be some natural and appropriate way of expression, even swaying right to left as you sit down or get up from zazen, is an expression of yourself. It is not preparation for practice or realization after practice. It is part of practice. So we should not take it as if we're preparing for something else. So we don't sit to prepare for something else that we're going to do outside this cushion. You know, whatever our activity is self the expression of your true nature. And more we deepen in our sense of appreciation of what this is. He goes on. To cook or fix some food is not preparation, according to Dogen. It is practice. To cook is not to just prepare food for someone or yourself. It is the expression of your sincerity. So when you cook, you should express yourself in your activity in the kitchen. You should allow plenty of time. You should work on it with nothing in your mind and without expecting anything. Work with as much tension as you can bring without expecting anything. This is also an expression of our sincerity, a part of our practice. It is necessary to sit in zazen in this way. But sitting is not our only way. Whatever you do, it should be expression of some deep activity. We should appreciate what we're doing. There is no preparation for something else. The Bodhisattva way, I'm saying this next sentence because in the next line in the Heart Sutra we're going to talk about the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva's way is called a single-minded way, or one railway track, 1,000 miles long. The railway track is always the same. If it were to become wider or narrow, it would be disastrous. Wherever you go, the railway track is always the same. This is the Bodhisattva's way. So even if the sun were to rise in the west, the Bodhisattva has only one way. His way is in each moment to express his nature and his sincerity. So the Bodhisattva way, you get on the railroad track, your railroad track is whatever I pass, whatever comes my way, is to try to express some deep feeling of appreciation, some deep feeling of gratitude, and some expression of prajna, of this deep interconnectedness with all things. So we just on the railway track. We like the scenery, we don't like the scenery. It rains, it doesn't rain. The train breaks down, it doesn't break down. Beautiful rolling hills, springtime in Sonoma. Snow, rain, sleet. The railway track just keeps going. And we're on the track, and whatever life presents to it, we try to meet with a sense of sincerity and appreciation. So that's more a sense of more... I mean, I think we can all understand. Not that we can do it or bring it so much into our lives a lot of the time, but we can appreciate that's what our practice is. So I wanted to give you this because when I start to talk about the Heart Sutra, I want you to think, how could this connect? How could studying the Heart Sutra help you in this way to be more immediate and appreciative in your life? I gave a couple of books last week on People Want to Follow Me. I suggested probably the first one was Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Heart of Understanding, a very easily understandable and accessible way to think of the Heart Sutra. Here's a paragraph that Red Pine, and I thought it was quite good, because in essence, it sums up what the Heart Sutra is trying to do, and puts it in a historical perspective. He starts off by saying there's like, the Buddhists distinguish three levels of wisdom, or prajna. The first level is the mundane level, where most of us hang out most of the time, actually. Which views is that permanent, impermanent is permanent, what is impure as pure, and what has no self as having a self. Those are the three marks. We really live our life more from the sense that things are solid, they're permanent, we put a lot of emphasis on ourselves, we forget others and other things, we take refuge in things like wealth, power, the number of friends we have. So that's the mundane level at which most of the world operates at, which most of us operate at most of the time. Buddha tried to change this. He tried to give us a different and a broader and a more expansive paradigm in which to look. The second level of prajna is the metaphysical wisdom, which views that what appears as permanent is really is impermanent. Was the heart of the early teaching. What appears to be pure as impure, that if we take refuge solely in material things, we're setting ourselves up for disappointment. And what appears to have a self is really not what we think it is. There's no self. This is a higher wisdom of those who cultivate meditation and philosophy, and is characteristic of such earlier schools. It's like the Savastivada school, which this sutra is coming out of that body of early Buddhist wisdom. This was the emphasis on the early teachings, actually 400 or 500 years. The emphasis was more this, the second level. The dialectic of the Heart Sutra is taking us to the third level, the more profound level and the more difficult level to really integrate into our life. The third level of prajna is transcendental wisdom, prajna paramita, the wisdom that goes beyond wisdom, which views all things, whether mundane or metaphysical, as neither permanent nor impermanent, as neither pure nor impure, as neither having self or not having self, as inconceivable and inexpressible. While mundane wisdom and metaphysical wisdom result in attachment to views and thus knowledge, the heart of most of our problems, transcendental wisdom remains free of views because it is based on insight that all things, both objects and dharmas, and dharmas here, we're using the term dharmas, is not meaning the teaching, but dharmas meaning constituent mental states, which I'll talk about in more depth, are empty of anything self-existent. Thus, nothing can be characterized as permanent, pure, or having a self, and yet neither can anything be characterized as impermanent, impure, or lacking a self. Now, this is a radical teaching. This is because there is nothing to which we can point and say, this is permanent or impermanent, this is neither pure nor impure, this is not a self or does not have a self. Such an ineffable wisdom was not known among early Buddhists. But if the written record is any indication, it did not attract much attention until such scriptures, such as the Heart Sutra, began to appear 400 or 500 years after Buddha. So this is what I'm talking about, is the Heart Sutra. This next level, this third level of prajna. So last week we were talking, and I think helpful by way of a little bit of a review, because I'm getting this one on tape. I didn't have last week on tape. So the first title is Maha Prajna Paramita. Maha means great, vast. So in one level it means great. Well, this is a great sutra. pay attention to it. But the real meaning is really without boundaries, without limits. It's really a metaphor, it's really a synonym for emptiness, for this vastness, this boundlessness, which we'll keep referencing in every line. So that's really what Maha. No separate thing. No edges. Not something that can be separated. So when we look at something like a book, we can see its separateness. We can see the boundaries. We can see how this is different from this. Right? But what the Heart Sutra is saying, let's look at this differently. Let's see if we can see this. Let's see if we can move to a level of prajna or wisdom where there's no boundaries here. That this book includes everybody in the room and includes the whole universe. So prajna is the word that's used, is that which cognizes emptiness. It cognizes, it has an understanding, a feeling for what this vastness, this boundlessness is. This sense, and we said before, the word we use, empty, well, let me just hold that for a minute. It's not empty in the conventional sense the way you use it. It means fullness. It means full of potential. One translation is pregnant with possibility. So prajna, and it isn't the conventional kind of wisdom that we normally use. Like we look, we cognize that this is a book, we cognize this is a particular kind of book. This kind of cognization is not conventional kind of knowledge. It's prajna. It's a transcendental kind of knowledge. So the way we think about this maha or this emptiness, which comes up again and again, it's a lot like impermanence. The earlier teachings of Buddhism really emphasized impermanence. But there's a little bit of elimination, a little bit of a limitation, and a little bit of a problem with the way the early Buddhists use impermanence. They saw that it was a problem if we took reference, a refuge in conditional things. Because the last words of the Buddha, all conditioned things are subject to pass. When he was dying and the disciples were grieving for him, he said, haven't I told you all along that all conditioned things, me, my body is a conditioned thing, all things will pass. Take refuge in that reality. And that emphasis gave a tremendous sense of equanimity and a tremendous sense of comfort. But maybe the downside is it emphasized a little bit too much detachment. In other words, we don't take refuge in things because we know they're going to fall apart, but it has a certain feeling of coolness to it. Like, well, let's not get too attached. It's all going to go. It's all not going to be, well, it's all, whatever. It's going to be okay. You know, it's all going to pass. So what this sutra began to do is it began to take emptiness, the concept of emptiness, to a much deeper level. A much deeper level about what, as we begin to see things as being boundless, and the emphasis was a sense of, because of impermanence, you couldn't emphasize any particular structure as standing apart or alone. Everything was connected. It began through, and you only can get through that understanding through a deep understanding of impermanence, that people begin to see that the result of this, after 400 or 500 years, very concentrated meditation practice and really studying deeply the permutations of emptiness, they become more to the place of seeing that emptiness really was almost identical with impermanence. An example would be, in the earlier teachings, and I followed this series up with our series on the hindrances. So in the earlier teachings, the way you would work with hindrances would be, well, we can see that if we have a lot of impatience and we have agitation and we don't have enough energy, we can't concentrate. We can't pay attention to our mind enough to really see the inherent clarity of our mind. We don't have the capacity to do that. And impermanence is one of the main tools. We see that whatever states, these dharma states that arise, these mental states that arise, that through impermanence we can just relax because we can just let them go. But using the Heart Sutra, we have a little different emphasis. We begin to see that in fact, not only are these hindrances hindrances, we don't even like to call them hindrances so much anymore. We see that these hindrances are not disconnected from our true reality, our natural states. And in fact, through using the hindrances, we have to have the hindrances to awaken. Mm-hmm. It's a very different way to see that. It's a very different way to see our own defilements. Instead of seeing our defilements as something we have to get rid of, we see them as a way to work with. And in fact, we need to be able to work with them to understand the interconnectedness of both the defilements and the state of mind, which is our, Suki Roshi would say, our true nature. It was interesting. I was sitting in the sun on my couch, and I was working through this lecture. And the phone rang. It was my son. He was in Fremont. We had gone down together the previous week and bought his second car. Pretty interesting, because when I was a kid, my universe was my car. It was arguable whether girls or car, what was most important. Probably, there was no question I put more energy in the car than I did girls. So, and maybe it's a paradigm shift, because in the modern generation, they actually, cars, you know, they're getting their license till they're 18 or 19, and unheard of in my generation, you know, the day after I was 16. But the point is that he's down there in Fremont, and he's buying this car, and he's had some problems, and he's going back, and he's totally into the relative world, totally into the materialistic world, trying to figure out what's wrong with this car, trying to get this car worked, trying to work it out with the guy that sold him the car, trying to work it out with the mechanic. He's calling me to try to get some consultation. I can just feel how attached he is to the material world. He's got to get this car to run. And he's right. He does. Right? I'm reading the Heart Sutra. My mind is like, the cars are conditioned. This car is going to fall apart. You're learning a valuable lesson here. I mean, I had 8, 9 cars before I was his age, and I watched them all disintegrate and fall apart, right? And I'm like pretty unattached to it, you know? And I think what's really more important here is your relationship with the mechanic. In your relationship with a guy that sold you a car that didn't really work. So the Heart Sutra is taking me to a completely different place than where he's at. And as I sat down this morning, I thought, pretty interesting. I've got the altar set up here, right? Which maybe I'll get to talking about, with Prajnaparamita and the little Buddha. And then the Buddha comes from Prajnaparamita. Then the Buddha turns to Avalokiteshvara and says, you know, why don't you give this Dharma talk today? This is what happens in the longer Heart Sutra. This is actually what happens. Avalokiteshvara is speaking the sutra. And of course today she's turning to me and saying, well, why don't you give it a shot today? And of course I'm saying, well, I can't do this without everybody here. I can't be giving this Dharma talk without everybody here. Right? So you can kind of see it, right? So anyway. So I just thought that was and what is that? What is the Heart Sutra about? It's about having a bigger perspective, and so I tried to give a little bit of that to him, you know, a little bit of that to him. That the most important thing here is not, in some ways, not that the car runs, but your relationship to your own state of mind about the fact that the car is falling apart and how it's pretty distressing for you, and you're beginning to contract around the mechanic and the. You know, what about, that's the more important thing that's really happening, right? Great, Dad. Let's just get this car on the road. So what begins to happen with impermanence is impermanence starts to become instead of something cool and distant, becomes something more warm and much more alive. And so if we started, you know, with emptiness, and then we begin to see that impermanence is a result of, or almost synonymous with emptiness, impermanence is almost synonymous, then the next thing we come to is that compassion, that's why Avalokiteshvara, who's the embodiment of compassion, is, she is the one who's giving the lecture, giving the Dharma talk. Compassion is a natural result of impermanence and emptiness. This is the heart of this sutra. That if we begin to see that things, there is no boundary, there is no limit, that in fact, everything is connected, compassion is inseparable from that realization. And the compassion begins to change. You know, the one definition for compassion is that our heart resonates with the suffering of the world. And I think that's a good definition. It kind of quakes. That's the word. It quakes with the suffering of the world. But actually, this is a kind of compassion almost that transcends the definition of the word. It's just a natural, it's a natural outpouring of understanding prajna. And one way to understand prajna is not, again, the sense of how you cognize something, like some kind of knowledge. It's almost like a felt sense. This, you can't really put it in words, right? This felt sense of, like, that I just belong in the world, that the world is connected with me. And you all have that experience. How can we abide more in that space? This felt sense. Can't really put a word to it. Isn't it true? Isn't it true in the Old Testament? Isn't there a section in the Old Testament where they, when they're trying to figure out the word for maha, or the word for emptiness, or the word for God, they couldn't figure out a word for it. So what did they, wasn't it Yahweh? Well, just use this word Yahweh, right? But really, we'd rather not use a word. That's the spirit of maha, and the spirit of kind of emptiness. Can you see that? That this is something that runs not just through the Buddhist tradition, but all religions, when they get to this point, it takes us to that third level of prajna, where all, it wants to put us in a space of wonderment, is what it's about. It's trying to take everything away from you. And of course, that's very fearful, that we get everything taken. It takes all the rugs out from under us. But we need all the rugs taken out from under us so we can get in this state of wonderment. No, not this. No, not this. No, no, it's not that. It's not that. What is it? What is it? And so we have a sense of anxiety. Well, what is it? There's nothing to hang on to. Just let go of that. Just keep letting go. Just keep letting go. That's what the Heart Sutra is trying to move us into. So one way to think about a nice metaphor that I learned, I've been helpful, is kind of like, suppose you were in the third level of compassion as being inseparable from emptiness. So suppose you stepped on a thorn, and the thorn was in your foot and it was causing pain. And the hand said, you know, I actually, it's not hurting up here. I'm not so interested in going down there and pulling the thorn out. That's the spirit. And that's where we abide, actually, a lot. You know? And this sutra is trying to address that. It's trying to move us beyond that, where this hand sees, in fact, it is experiencing some pain, and it needs to come to the assistance of the foot. Something very practical. So compassion actually is the natural state of emptiness. It's a natural expression. In fact, there's nothing but compassion all the time, because there's nothing but emptiness all the time. It's just that we don't realize it. So the next line in the, so that's just the title. So the next line in the Heart Sutra, which is, and maybe again we'll chant it. The next line is, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing the Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates, this is the second translation, this is the more traditional translation, not the one, on the one that we usually do. It's on the next page, second page. All five aggregates are empty and was thus relieved of suffering. So that one sentence probably sums up the Heart Sutra in some ways. Well, actually, that in the next sentence. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptying itself is form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are all like this. Those are the aggregates, also translated as the skandhas. And if you start to study Buddhism, you're going to run across that phrase again and again, the skandhas, the skandhas. I took it out of the translation because when people come to sit in here and we turn out the Heart Sutra, I didn't want to have to explain each time what skandhas were. But I am going to do it now. And probably next lecture. Because it's kind of seminal to understanding about the Heart Sutra and how the Heart Sutra came into existence. So first, we have Buddha. And then people begin to realize that, well, what made a Buddha? What made a Buddha was Prajnaparamita. This transcendental wisdom is what makes a Buddha. All Buddhas are people that understand and abide in Prajnaparamita. So because Prajnaparamita was indefinable, you couldn't empty it. It's very hard to talk about it, although I seem to be doing a pretty good job, and there actually are books and books about it. They decided to create an icon that would help people a little bit. So this is the icon that's been on this altar for 15 years. This is a woman figure, Prajnaparamita, who's the mother of all Buddhas. So the Prajnaparamita is the mother, because all Buddhas are birthed through Prajnaparamita. Okay? And then the natural result of a Buddha, his enlightenment, is Avalokiteshvara. And it's interesting that the two main, and I've said this many times, the two main bodhisattvas are Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of compassion, and Manjushri. And Manjushri actually usually sits in a Zen meditation, all with a sword to cut through ignorance, right? This is the Chinese manifestation, or Japanese manifestation of Avalokiteshvara, which is Kuan Yin or Guan Yin, often depicted in the mantra, in the tanka that I have with a thousand arms. It means the Lord, because originally it was a male figure and then an androgynous figure and then eventually moved to being a female figure because people could resonate more with a female figure with the feminine principles of nurturing and caring rather than just thinking. The Lord who hears the cries of the world. That's what Avalokiteshvara. Hears all the suffering of the world. And then a thousand arms to respond in a thousand ways, in a multitude of ways of addressing each person's suffering. That kind of spirit is Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. And I think that definition I gave, Bodhi means, great being. Or being that is on the path to really trying to manifest and understand more deeply prajna. Or on the train, going through life with that vow. That vow of trying to again and again see the limitation of your own point of view. Not to give up your point of view, but to see limitation and try to include things and to see things with a compassionate heart. Going through life on the railway track that way. And the next word is very important. Avalokiteshvara. Bodhisattva, when practicing, it isn't practiced, it isn't realized, it's practicing. Meaning, you know what? What is that? Present continuous tense? Constantly. Not finished. Always doing it. On the railway track. Not feeling that I'm doing this and then I finally have got prajna, I finally realized it and I'm a realized Buddha. No, the emphasis now is like more the bodhisattva. The person that just continues to practice, continues to manifest, continues to sit and try to manifest and let their true nature be revealed to them. So that's the spirit. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Practicing deeply the Prajna Paramita. Perceived that all five skandhas are aggregates in their own being are empty. Okay, this is a very important phrase. What are skandhas? So what skandhas are, well, let's start this way. We create the world through our own perception, right? It's our perception of the world is what we create our reality. And Buddha saw that there was some limitation in terms of how we perceived it. Somehow the way we perceived it caused suffering because he saw suffering in himself and everybody. So as he began to meditate using the traditions that existed before him, concentration practice, he began to meditate, he began to observe his states of mind through very concentrated meditation practice. And what he began to see was he began to see himself differently. He began to see himself instead of being Shakyamuni, the lord of the Shakyas, he began to see himself as just these five aggregates or five skandhas. Another definition or a translation is heaps. He began to see these heaps of how he built the world, these building blocks of the world. He began to see the five skandhas. He began to see himself. Well, I have ears, I have eyes, tongue, taste, touch. The skandha, the rupa skandha, the first skandha. Then he began to see that these senses reached out and made a contact. And these contacts resulted in a perception. Purple socks. Sutra book. You begin to define and create the universe through your definitions, which are taught to you. Then you begin to see that feelings resulted from that. I love purple socks. I don't like that sutra cover. I do actually, but you begin to see that you had three perceptions. Pleasant, I like it, I want to go towards it, I gotta have more of it. Unpleasant, I don't like that. I want to push away. Aversion, right? One of the hindrances. The first one, attraction, potentially one of the hindrances. Or neutral, the three feelings, okay? The three feelings gave rise to the samskaras, or the impressions. And the samskaras are everything we do with the rupa, making contact, having perception, and then everything follows. Anger, jealousy, aversion, attachment, all the emotional mishugana that happens from these perceptions. We start to create our emotional reality and how we engage in the world through these samskaras. And they all happens in the fifth samskara, which is consciousness. So he began to see this in his meditation practice. And the deeper he saw this, he began to see that what he thought he was really just these building blocks of consciousness. And that was very important to him. Then, what Avalokiteshvara says is something extraordinarily radical and extraordinary. It's like anarchistic. You know, people go on these things, you'd say it in a In fact, there's a sutra that says this. You actually took 500 years to get to a point where somebody could say this. Then he says it, and like, you know, 1,000 monks get up and leave. It's just way too radical. It's just like, we can't deal with this. And he says, these skandhas in their own being are empty. And because I see this, and because this is true, that is how you eliminate suffering. Is if you can see, you can take it to the next step. And this is what the sutra is doing. It is taking it to the next step. So if we look at this as we look at quantum physics, can you imagine what it would be like if, first of all, we just see the body, right? And then, you know, who knows when they started to carve the body up and they saw, oh, this is amazing. There's muscles and nerves and tendons and hearts and lungs. And people begin to have a deeper understanding. And it was so radical that, in fact, the church would, what, you're a heretic. They'd burn you if you actually started to perform anatomy on people. It was so radical. It was so threatening. And then the next step, at some point, people said, well, you know what? We think there is something called molecules. And that, how radical that was, you know, how radical it is. And then you go to the next step and you say, well, you know what? Molecules are made up of atoms. Okay, well, you know, we now have microscopes. We can actually see it. Empirically, we can prove it. Okay? So now we're at the level of skandhas. We see that human beings aren't what we think they are. They're skandhas. Okay, we can see that. And we really understand that. And the more we really understand that, our whole concept of just being a self dissolves. We begin to see we're just a process of these skandhas appearing again and again and again. And we don't have to take ourselves so seriously. But then we come along and somebody says, actually, atoms don't really exist. That atoms are energy. That is pretty radical, right? We're still trying to wrap our heads around that. That you're just energy. And that maybe your energy isn't any different than just a big pool of energy. And so quantum physics is moving us in that direction, right? Well, that's what happened in the Heart Sutra, beginning in about the 2nd century BC, and then this was written about around the 1st century. It begins to say, you're all these things that you think you are. You can't point to anything. All this whole 500 years of meditation practice, the Sarvastivadins had a whole system of psychology which was incredibly useful and valuable, called the Abhidharma. 75 dharmic states. They said, okay, here's a dharmic state. No, we don't know that one. Okay, let's add that one. And then there were five other schools that said, no, 0.7 is not really a dharmic state. I mean, this went on for 500 years. It was great because it got people to really pay attention and the concentration, but they were losing the big picture here. They were losing the big picture. And so the Heart Sutra brings this big picture back. It says, no, even these skandhas don't really exist. These skandhas do not exist as separate entities. These skandhas in their own being, meaning in their own little heaps, do not exist. There's no boundary to these heaps. You've got to give this up. Well, this was radical. This was like complete anarchism in Buddhist psychology. Like, oh my God, then what is there? We have to throw out all these 500 years of kind of study, which in fact you don't, because the study is a building block to get to this place. You can't get to this under this sense of the third level of prajna without doing all the other. And it isn't a progressive step. It's all inclusive. You're doing it all the time anyway. So we begin to see that the skandhas, in fact, are just a flow. That all there is flow and connectivity. Flow and connectivity. So maybe that's a good place to end today. and we'll pick it up next week when we start to move into form is emptiness and emptiness is form. But a lot of what I'm going to be talking about will just be in some ways deepening this understanding. And they start to go through all the different points of Buddhist doctrine and start to show that each one of these points, the Four Noble Truths, all these things are in fact empty. Everything's empty. It's all empty. And what is the natural culmination of that? So let's finish by chanting the more traditional Heart Sutra. This is the one that's chanted in with a few word variations in Zen monasteries every morning and in a lot of Tibetan practice. Heart of the Great Wisdom Sutra. I'll follow, chant it along with me. Have you got it? Page 2. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and was thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, forms is not different from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself is form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also lifeless. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. Therefore, given emptiness, there is no form, no sensations, no perceptions, no formations, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. There is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death, nor extinction of old age and death. No suffering, no cause, no sensation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on Prajnaparamita, and the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. All Buddhas of the past, present, and future rely on the Prajnaparamita and therefore attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore know the Prajnaparamita as the great miraculous mantra, the great right mantra, the supreme mantra, the incomparable mantra, which removes all suffering and is true, not false. Therefore, we proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra, the mantra that says, Gate Gate Har Gate Par Sangate Bodhisattva. Gone, gone, gone beyond. Pure presence, ever transcending. It is suchness. It is awakeness. So, when you read that, didn't it start to make a little more sense to you when I said? Now do you kind of understand? You're starting to get it, right? What they're trying to do here? Good. Good. I mean, I've been studying this for 30 years, 35 years. And every time I study it, I learn something a little bit more. But it's not, I mean, studying helps, but it just encourages you to try to deepen it, to slow down a little bit, and just feel connected. How do I disconnect from things? Yeah. Okay, let's may our intention equally penetrate every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings harmless are bowed to the fore and with them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are endless. I vow to enter them. Whose way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So even the end chant Does it make a little more sense? I mean, what we're doing, you know, every day we deepen a little bit more what those vows are that we say. A little bit more. Beings are numberless, boundless. Beings. It used to be sentient beings. I took out sentient because everything, right? Everything. How do we live for and with them? That's our vow. That's our vow. Okay. Let's have a little tea. Does anybody know? Okay, are we going to be able to do it here or out in the? Do we know?
Well, I think that we can start out here.
And then we may need to adjourn out. But we should probably think about maybe making it a little shorter. We should probably try to maybe by 5 of or something because people are going to start to come. Okay, a little shorter today. Okay, thank you all.
Thank you.